So I'm very happy to being able to present Richard Kadrey. And the last time we met in person was, I guess, like 10 years ago, 1998. And we had a burrito somewhere, I guess.
Roosevelt's Tamale Parlor. I remember that.
Yes, yes, yes. And the only thing, it was, Monochrome was pretty much doing lots of stuff back then, except the fanzine. But I had a copy of the Monochrome fanzine for you with a short list of, I can remember about, like, was it Dead Media? I'm not sure. We translated.
Oh, yeah, it was one of the early Dead Media lists.
Yeah, 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 we, because, and I was always a big, big fan of Dead Media, and so I always wanted to show Richard the Dead Media article, pretty much a translation of a thing you did, and we translated it to German, I guess.
Yeah. The Dead Media project was something I did with Bruce Sterling. It's actually ongoing in a very small way, which we're literally trying to list every kind of human communication device that is sort of not used anymore. I mean, and some of them are very, you know, something like the quipu, as far back as that, and up to odd things like the singing telegraph, which is this odd version in which you sort of pumped a little extra electricity through there, and they found that by adjusting the electricity, you could actually get different tones. So it's almost like an early theremin, just listing all that. The telharmonium, the most famous musical instrument pre-World War I, the first synthesizer ever
made. It was
made.
As big as a whole train.
It was the size of a freight train car, and it weighed something like 50 tons, the last one. And it was such a disaster at the end that they literally just pushed it into the ocean. I mean, it was just, there was just nothing to do with it. It was so bankrupt by then, they couldn't store it. There was nothing to do. Just tip it over. So there are no recordings, no physical evidence that it ever existed.
Yeah. I mean, a really nice story is that back in the 1980s, someone told me, you know, like the computing power of the whole Apollo program, like bringing a man to the moon, that's pretty much the Commodore 64. And I could say, okay, oh, wow, Commodore 64. But nowadays, what shall I say? Like, it's like just a tiny little part of an iPhone? I don't know. It's so like a Commodore 64.
Basically,
it's a wristwatch, yeah, probably, yeah.
And they had three of them on the landing module, and all three failed, by the way. A lot of people don't know
and
that.
They
actually landed by hand. That's why they had a pilot, because they actually had to land manually when all three of their computers failed.
I'm not sure if it's an urban legend, but there's this really cool story about that the Americans invested quite a lot of money into creating a pen that could write in zero gravity. And the Russians, of course, they used pencils, you know. But then again, there's a problem with the Russian side because, I mean, you have to sharpen the stupid pencil. And if that fucking opens in, oh my, that would be really bad. I don't know. That would be, maybe that's a good start for talking about science fiction and sexuality.
Things that go wrong.
Things that go wrong, yeah. So, Richard, you are a BDSM photographer. You are a science fiction author. You're a fantasy author. And that's why I think it's a really good idea to have you on stage here. Because it's Ars Electronica. The topic is, do androids sleep with electric sheep? It's about sex and science fiction and social fiction, of course. And could you tell me a little bit about your, in German we would say Sozialisation, your socialization. So how did you start writing science fiction and how did you start getting interested in BDSM and how does it work together? What do you think?
Well, I think there's a very logical connection between sort of science fiction, at least modern science fiction, and the fetish world, and that you're talking about both the idea of sort of the fetishistic object, the object that is in science fiction, there is a kind of obsession with what is the functionality of the future, the objects we use in the future, how they relate to us. And, you know, fetishism works often the same way, even if it's as something as simple as, I know some foot fetish photographers I've been talking to down in L.A., and, I mean, it's that kind of zeroing in on that single object, and also the idea of just basic obsession. I think there's a different kind of obsessive quality to both science fiction and the fetish world than in sort of the general fiction world versus just the kind of idea of sort of Playboy hustler kind of sexual obsession, the kind of thing of wanting to push boundaries, sort of see what's further down the road, what's on the other side, to experiment both intellectually and physically with your own body, with what surrounds you.
I mean, it's really interesting that a couple of really good science fiction collections were published by Playboy, I guess,
yes,
in the 1970s, mm-hmm, or something like that. So
Playboy was the first American publisher of Ballard's Crash over here.
Really?
Yeah, they did the first paperback. If you can find the old paperback, the blue cover that had like this sports car with tits for headlights. Have you ever seen this thing? I lost it years ago. It's an amazing cover if you could ever find it. It's beautiful in this complete trashy exploitation pulp way. It's really rare. I only found it once and went away.
Okay, so staying with, Crash is probably a good topic to talk
That's
about, yeah?
A great one.
So we have a guy called J.G. Ballard, and he writes about pretty much techno fetishism, and he writes about sex and death. I mean, we have here a machine. It's not here at the moment, but yesterday Stéphane Perrin won a Prix Ars Electronica award for his dildonic device that would only vibrate when there's in one mode if there's an earthquake somewhere. So if there's an earthquake, that dildo would actually vibrate. And he has a different version where it pretty much measures Iraqi civilian body counts. And it would. So I like this connection between sex and death. And obviously, sex and death is like a major thing going on in Crash. So was there anything going on before Crash, or is Crash somehow was pretty much defining a techno fetishistic sex death
thing? Well, it's the one everyone points to. It's the most obvious one, that obsessive, that real obsession between machine, body, and the destruction and rearrangement of both. But there was plenty of stuff before that. Dr. Adder by K.W. Jeter is a book that came out in the 80s, in which it's this very violent, very sexual book. In which a character, Dr. Adder, this radical surgeon living in a future L.A., finds the sexual obsessions of willing subjects and then alters their bodies in these radical ways. I mean, amputation, augmentation of genitalia, turns people into basically organic, fetishistic fuck machines. And it was only published in the 80s, but it was written in 1972. And it was only published in the 80s because no one would touch it in the 70s.
Okay. 1972 seems to be an interesting year in history, because one of my favorite short stories about sex and science fiction by a guy named Tiptree. Tiptree was no guy. It was a pseudonym for a female science fiction author.
Alice Sheldon, I believe.
Yes. And she wrote an excellent short story about a space station somewhere in the middle of nowhere, and she's writing that humans are pretty much completely obsessed by aliens because they want to fuck the aliens, and the aliens pretty much know, hey, come on, it's not as if the humans would be the slaves of the aliens, so the aliens are not in a way like forcing them to work for them or do like shitty jobs for them, but the humans are so, they want to be near the aliens. They are so attracted by these alien creatures, and they want to have sexual intercourse with them. And it's pretty much, and I think she uses a metaphor where she talks about that, that the colonists going to Polynesia, and that's the same thing as where they would pretty much intrude like the genetic multiplicity in Polynesia. So like white colonists would go there and pretty much fuck up the genetic order of the whole islands there. And she's somehow referring to that when she thinks about, hey, if there would be aliens around, our genetic drive would force us to want to fuck them, but it would be useless and we would pretty much be the slaves of the aliens. I think it's a really, weird but somehow interesting idea about sexual forces in ourselves that we cannot control. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I mean, there's a long history in science fiction of that obsession of the other. You know, sex with the other. I mean, it's a logical extension of meeting the aliens. And I mean, again, this goes back a long way. You have stories, a nice story. I mean, a lot of Tiptree stories have to do with sexuality and gender roles are not happy stories.
No.
But, you know, there's a fairly kind of romantic and oddly sweet story by Lester Del Rey from the late 30s called Helen O'Loy, in which a man and a friend of his construct a female robot, and he just falls in love with her in this completely romantic way. And basically, the man and the robot live as husband and wife for, you know, their entire lives. So that obsession's been there for a long, long time. Even, you know, you could even put it in terms of, you can go back, it's not explicit in something like The Time Machine by H.G. Wells, but there are certain implications in the book. You have the underground dwellers, the Morlocks, and you have the Eloi on Earth, and they're kidnapping, the Morlocks are constantly kidnapping the Eloi and taking them down below.
And consuming them.
And consuming them, which itself is a nice sexual metaphor, but there is, you can also read into that there is some sexual component beyond the metaphorical in that kind of relationship, that raiding relationship on the weaker people who are all feminized. I mean, the Eloi are very feminized creatures in general, the males and the females. And so you have this sort of predatory, very violent, very strong group. So, you know, it's been there for a long time. And if you go back even to sort of the Greek myths, I mean, you know, Leda and the Swans, I mean, things like that. It's always, that obsession's been there, and you have it in modern pornography, you know, all the interracial, you know, combinations that are, again, this fetishistic form, you know, midget porn. I mean, I think fits right in there, too. It's just always that sexual obsession with the other. What would that be like? How can I obsess over something that is not me or mine?
Yeah, and especially nowadays where random porn is pretty much accessible on the internet and it's pretty easy to produce. I mean, the whole, like, Annalyn Newitz was talking about the tentacle porn thing yesterday as part of the...
I have all these friends who are now obsessed with tentacle porn. I've actually shot. I did a tentacle porn shoot.
Yeah, actually, I would have thought that tentacle porn only exists because of the Japanese... censorship thing going on, that you can't show a dick, and therefore someone started to create tentacles. But actually, I think, and pretty much Annalyn Newitz told me that it's only an urban myth, and that the tentacle, sex and tentacle thing is going on in Japanese culture, I guess, for a couple of hundred years now. So
there's old paintings. It's an old obsession over there. I mean, which makes sense. I mean, it's an island. They've had this very strong relationship to the sea. A lot of people, a lot of cultures that have that strong relationship to water have the same mythology. There's Amazonian myths about freshwater dolphins. And in fact, supposedly, there were these sort of coming of age rituals where young fishermen fuck the freshwater dolphins down there. I mean, it's a strong part of the mythology. It also works for the women because sometimes the dolphins come out of the water, fuck the women along the Amazon, and then they have these kind of mer babies, which, you know, is a really nice way to cover up if you're pregnant from an affair. You just sort of like, oh, it was the dolphins, dude. Not my fault.
There's a nice Micronesian myth that, like, the entire, like, the world was created because a god fucked an anthill. I mean, mm-hmm. I really like that. So I probably wouldn't try it, but I like. But it's a god, anyways. Well, I mean,
it depends on the ants, I suppose.
That's right. I mean,
there are sexier ants than others. I mean,
okay, but concerning ants, I mean, there is violence is a strong thing going on in science fiction. Like many science fiction films and novels are extremely violent, so they're in a certain way exaggerating like what's going on. So they are finding metaphors and even amplify in a certain way things that are going on in the real world. So I think that science fiction is never about the future, it's always about the present.
Always. And,
yeah. So how could it be about the future? I'm not believing in the future, so where is it? Point at it. So what do you think are the main steps, like, let's say the last 50 years, we have like last 50 years of science fiction and fantasy. Let's add fantasy in a certain way. So what do you think, what would be really interesting examples of sex and science fiction, let's say in the 50s, in the 60s, in the 70s, how did society evolve and how did science fiction evolve in talking about sex in science fiction?
Well, what's really interesting over that period is you sort of had this boom in the 70s, and then it's, especially in science fiction, and it slowly died down again, and I can't quite say if that's marketing forces or if that's just a general repression that began in the 80s. There's just a lot of fear, the sort of Reagan administration, and the reaction to what a lot of Americans, you know, consider the hyper-sexualized 70s. But to go back to the 50s, the 50s are really interesting because in that post-war world, it was consumed mostly by fear. I mean, it was a lot like these days. You have the end of the war, you have the rise of communism, we never defeated them, and the Soviets are becoming stronger, and they have the bomb. There's this consuming fear that runs through that whole period. And there's this sort of return after the war when women had these very important jobs. Women were pretty much equal with men, doing these heavy industrial jobs, building machines, building jets, building bombs for the war effort. All the guys came home, and it's like, thanks, honey, make dinner. And there's this just desperate desire to return to what a lot of Americans, a lot of American men, thought of as normal American life. And that's really reflected in a lot of pop culture.
And especially because, like, they were thinking, what's a normal American life? They were returning from the war and pretty much fictionalizing, like,
exactly,
the whole war, like, about, I want a normal life. And then they are, like, pretty much
idealized
what
we look at now is the Leave It to Beaver world, which just became this imaginary goal while you were, you know, living in filth and shit and being shot at all the time. So you have this return to this alleged normalcy and this rigid, this very rigid codified gender role system, almost a class system that's set in the 50s. And you can see some of my favorite, I think the easiest way to talk about it is one of my favorite films is Them. The giant ant movie from the 50s.
It's really great.
It's actually a really great movie.
We just showed it in, as we have this ongoing monochrome series of films that we present, and we just showed it like half a year ago because it's such a brilliant thing
to discuss. For talking about sort of sexual roles and things like that, it's sort of the perfect one that covers a lot of what happened in the 50s. You have essentially giant ants are created by a nuclear test. You need to know.
Yeah, but it's pretty much like the style is, it's a film noir. It's a film noir about giant ants, and that's pretty much, I think that's explaining
it
pretty much.
It's okay. Well, let me just say this, okay, and I'll argue why it's not noir.
Okay.
By the way, it's the presidential debate you're watching at the moment.
Did everybody TiVo it?
I did.
But Them, the social setup in Them is great, and it's something that carries through all the 50s. There's this also obsession that started with Einstein, the sort of genius, unsexualized figure who is sort of, in an old myth, he'd be the wizard who knows everything, but has no relationship to the human body. It's all in the head. And you have the three main characters in there. You have the scientist, his daughter, and the sort of outside guy who comes in. And the three figures you see all through the 50s are the older, completely desexualized male, the hot woman.
Semi-incompetent.
Well, incompetent socially.
Yeah,
always
yeah,
a
yeah.
genius, but socially he's bumbling. And that's why his daughter's around taking care of him, because she's very young, very beautiful, should be out there in the world, but she's not because she's taking care of her bumbling genius dad.
And in them, she's the first thing you see of her is her ass. She's climbing down the ladder of a plane. So, and you have this almost like a zoom on her ass, and she's climbing down, and then she's the scientist. Uh-huh.
She's a scientist, but she's not allowed to be an adult woman.
But she's allowed to climb into the giant anthill. She's allowed to. She climbs in there.
She can do the kind of science thing, but she can't react at all to the sexuality of being an adult woman. She could be just a vestal virgin. Yeah. She is doing nothing. She's just taking care of dad and doing science. And she doesn't have any relationship to her body or sexuality until the other guy comes in. And that's the man of action. That's the dude coming back from the war. That's the cowboy. That's the guy who's going to rescue her.
It's pretty much like a father figure. It's like,
fuck her.
Like this baby boomer generation father figure in a certain way. The guy coming back from the war, who can handle it.
The virile guy coming back, not the older guy. It's the guy who can come back, rescue her, and inevitably fuck her and make her a housewife. It's like, again, that's what's going to happen. That's the end of that story that they don't show you in the movie. I know you were a scientist and you saved us from the giant ants, but make dinner.
Yeah. Okay.
That's the part you never see, but that's where it's all going. But that's the sort of setup for most of the 50s. It's that kind of ritualized role pattern to try and grab something that feels normal and safe in a time when, again, you're coming out of the bomb, you see the rise of the Soviets, and you're also seeing a lot of angry men come home. There's a lot of people, they don't talk about that in culture. There's this famous Gregory Peck movie called The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit. It's a very serious movie that actually deals with that, about a guy coming back from the war. He's a real straight arrow guy. He's a nice businessman, and he's trying to just be a normal guy coming back from the war, fit into his American life. But all he thinks about is everyone he killed, all of his friends that he killed, and it's ruining his life. He cannot get past it. And it's just not talked about. I mean, we all think that post-traumatic stress was never diagnosed till the Vietnam War. But in fact, if you go back through history, you see it constantly. I had an uncle that it was a joke in my family that if there's a family reunion and Uncle Bob happens to fall asleep, he had some food, he had a drink, he fell asleep by the tree over there, no one goes near Uncle Bob. Because if you wake up Uncle Bob, he will snap your neck. Because whenever he's asleep, he's back at Guadalcanal. And you're a Japanese soldier, and he will fucking kill you. And the biggest worry, of course, was hurting the children away from him.
But that's a good point. I mean, let's talk about robots.
Let's talk about robots.
I mean, we're now in the 1950s. Like, if you go on to the 1960s, and that's pretty much maybe a good thing to talk about robots, we have stuff going on like Barbarella. I mean, and Barbarella, I mean, I'm not even sure if Barbarella back then was a financial success. I'm not sure. I mean,
I think it was.
Okay, there's sex in it. Probably it was, yeah. But Barbarella,
Jane Fonda at her at the height of who she was, too.
Yeah, it's a European film, so...
That's right. Vadim directed it, didn't he? Roger Vadim.
And could you think about... a specific, a really important, movie or book of the 1960s that is somehow addressing sexual roles or like maybe not in a, as a provocative way as Barbarella does, because Barbarella, it's quite obvious what's going on here. So it was a I think it was a comic before then. I guess it was.
Yeah, it was a French comic.
It was a French comic.
I think it was in, what's the French name for heavy metal? Metal Hurlant or something
like
that.
Yeah.
I think it's from there.
Okay. So, because many people are referring to, we have the 1960s, there's flower power, there's whatever going on, and of course there's Barbarella. But I guess there's tons of more stuff besides Barbarella that nobody's actually thinking about when you think, maybe even the early 1960s. I mean, the 1960s, all the people refer to the 1960s as this, decade of turmoil. But I mean, the early 1960s, they were still pretty conservative. I mean, lots of things going on in the late 1960s, but the early 1960s,
sort of from the mid to late. I mean, you're talking about like 66 to 68 when things started
to tremble.
Exactly. It is in the 60s that, of course, I'm blanking on some titles here, that you first start seeing the sort of new idea of social roles, where you start seeing things like redefines gender roles, not such rigid divisions between gay and straight, what kind of marriages are there. You start seeing the idea of what are future families. You're starting to see things like group marriages. I think even something as dicey as something like Stranger in a Strange Land is coming out of that culture and from that period. I don't know if it was actually published in the 60s, but it comes out of that kind of ethos, even though it's a very questionable book in some ways. But Heinlein was an interesting figure in that, in which he kind of vacillated back and forth.
He was a polyamorous guy, actually, or?
Yeah, but intellectually, he really was kind of all over the place. Some people kind of excuse some of it, because apparently he had some kind of brain blockage for a lot of his life and was sort of deranged. But he was an older guy who came out of a certain culture. And so when he was trying to write kind of radicalized stuff, he was still at the same time very homophobic for part of it. But then later, he actually, and of course I can't remember the name of the title of the book, there was this kind of emancipation, as was this end of fear of gay culture. So in a weird way, I mean, he's kind of emblematic of a kind of writer that came out, that kind of went through that whole period of starting to write in the 30s up through the, I don't know if he made it to the 80s, but he was definitely writing in the 70s and definitely changed. And even if the change was a commercial idea, it's still emblematic of what was going on in the culture.
Yeah, of course. I mean, if the market forces you to be liberal, that's strange.
Well, it's not liberal. It's
of course, no. I wouldn't take the term liberal and combine it with Heinlein. Not really.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I'm stepping away now from the timeline, but I like what Verhoeven did with Starship Troopers when he took it like in the late when he took it in the late 1990s, and he pretty much created this, like, because Starship Troopers itself is not a completely like anti-war thing, actually.
No, not at all.
And Verhoeven takes it and twists it around and creates this like anti-fascist metaphor and spits it out into pop culture, and most of the people who went to see the film didn't even get the message. They were just thinking, oh, cool, they're semi-fascist or even fascist guys, and they're killing ants.
Fascist,
cool.
It's a fascist romp.
Yeah.
It's my favorite thought about the thing, which, you know, in the end becomes this anti-fascist thing. But it's this beautiful, banal representation of all that kind of ethos that, again, isn't the future, isn't the Nazi imagery, isn't the past. It's definitely that kind of rigidity you're seeing in, again, George Bush's America.
Yeah. Okay, but let's step back to the 1970s. Let's go on through the decades. In the 1970s, there's lots of dystopian things going on. I mean, even Star Wars itself is a highly dystopian. Actually.
I don't want to talk about Star Wars.
Okay,
fuck Star Wars.
No. Okay.
Actually, Star Trek has some very weird gender stuff. You want to talk about that?
That's right. I mean, the only thing I'm always thinking about Star Trek is, how do they, I mean, do they teleport the shit out of, they don't have toilets. There is not a single toilet in the whole fucking Star Trek universe.
I actually wrote an article about that once, of like all the backroom stuff that they don't talk about on Star Trek, of like how basically...
How is Picard shitting? What is he doing? How?
And in fact, everyone, let's face it, everyone's drinking everyone's piss. Because if they're out there for a long time, you're recycling all that water. And the great part is, you're drinking alien piss. So who the fuck knows what that is.
Okay, the 1970s, dystopian world.
It's not necessarily dystopian. The 70s are when science fiction officially went batshit.
Yeah. I mean, for example, the German title is... Flucht ins 23. Jahrhundert.
I'm just waiting, man.
Michael York, the big
Logan Run.
Logan's Run. Oh, it's such a nice Logan's Run. Flucht ins 23. Jahrhundert.
Okay, translate that literally. What does that mean?
Escape into the 23rd century.
What a awful title. What a terrible title.
They did a lot of bad things, like in translating and dubbing things to German.
Is this because I know in some other countries what they're doing with science fiction, or not anymore necessarily, is because it's just genre material, they just gave it to some guy, said translate it in 24 hours, and it's just crap.
No, the translations, actually, it depends on where. There's a big publisher in Germany, Heine, and Heine, I think they were bought by Random House, and they're pretty okay. The interesting thing, it's happening all the time, pretty much. Sometimes the titles get longer, and sometimes the titles get shorter. There's Down and Out in Magic Kingdom by Cory Doctorow, and I think the German title is Upload. Or something like that. So they thought of. I think it's pretty much like an economic necessity. They say, like the publishers say. So we have the Cory Doctorow. He's well known, but you know, like maybe conservative German science fiction readers. Who knows? It has to be a catchy title that somehow refers to the stuff that the guy is doing. The people have to be attracted to go and actually take the book, look at it, and maybe buy it. So, and they thought of, hey, let's
that
call it
a very retro title for
let's call it Upload. Yeah, let's call it Upload because I mean, you know, it's somehow about, you know, net stuff. The guy is a blogger. I don't know. It's strange. So
that's a good title. Something about net stuff. Call it that.
Okay, Logan's Run. Flucht ins 23. Jahrhundert. Michael York, still the same name in German. And Michael Jörg, actually. So, what I find, there is definitely like a sexual component in this, like this like hedonistic world where you actually only can live until you're, I don't know, 25 or something, like 30, and then they send you to the carousel to burn you.
But, I mean, it's all sex. That's all that movie is really about. Because it is that worship of youth and beauty.
Yeah.
Whatever else is going on, it is purely a sexual theme.
It's like at Google, I guess. I mean, when you go to the Google campus, it looks like Logan's Run. Go to the Google campus. They have free naked juice there, okay? Actually, I tried to steal naked juice there, like 25 bottles, because they get it for free. I thought, hey, I'll take some. I'm a European artist. I take some naked juice with me. And then they were staring at me that I'm carrying it out. And what the fuck? What are you thinking? You're fucking Google. You can afford to give me 25 naked juice here. And you're probably not even paying for that, because naked juice, it's bringing it for you. I don't know. But... The whole architecture, the Google campus, is highly reminding me about Logan's Run, and especially all the
more like Starship Troopers down there.
And all the people sitting there around there working and programming and playing billiard and drinking naked juice and having a whirlpool there and feeling fine. And when they are 30, they probably get burnt. Or they have to work for, I don't know, Yahoo or stuff. I don't know.
This place. I mean, I did my .com time, and it was kind of fascinating because there was this kind of fake hedonistic part of it, this fake comfort. I mean, yes, there's a whirlpool. Yes, there's a couch. By the way, you're working 80, 100 hours a week. And, you know, it's this fake kind of payment for you. I mean, at least in Logan's Run, they were getting laid.
Yeah. I mean, people I don't know about the being late count at Google. I don't know about that. But I know that they have the Google shuttle bus taking employees, Google's employees from their home to Google, and they have, of course, wireless access in the shuttle bus. So the Google employees start working when they step out of their home into the shuttle bus. They start working there. And actually, they don't force them to work. It's just like, hey, we have access here, so you can use it. Do whatever you like. And of course,
and that's the brilliance. That's sort of the anti-sex part of the modern world that doesn't get talked about that much. The future Logan's Run, all about hedonism, but the result of our technology has been the opposite, to consume all our time and to take us out of all the leisure time that we were promised at the beginning of this. There's a really good example at the beginning of the 20th century. There were all these household products made for women. The vacuum, and especially the biggest one, was the washing machine. Before that, women had to have this drudgery of, like, once a week, they had this, you know, pile of clothes the size of a bear that they had to wash, and it was terrible. So what do we give women? We give women the washing machine to help them, to give them leisure time. Only what happens is it is now expected that the family has clean clothes 24/7. So this lovely washing machine that's supposed to free women from the drudgery of washing consumes their lives, because they are expected to wash and fucking wash and fucking wash for the family all the time. It is the exact opposite of what everyone was promised. And I think it's a lot of the same in modern digital technology and digital culture.
Of course, there's this shift from like a disciplinary society towards a society of control. And in a disciplinary society, you pretty much know who is your enemy. There's a worker and there's a boss, and there's a clear distinction between the worker and the boss, and there's a whole culture constructed around that like there's a worker's culture, and we pretty much know where the boundary is between us and you fucker, okay? So we know it, yeah? And nowadays, in the society of control, as Deleuze pretty much describes it, the boundary is blurry, and that's what actually is happening at Google. So if you're a friend of your boss, then you are not fucking with your friends. And of course, he's not your friend. There's still the same means of production. There's still the same bullshit going on. You just believe that you're in control. You believe that you're in control about your life, and it's pretty much the same shit going on like as the last couple of decades. But people feel free, and that's a little bit of a problem, because they are their own enemies now. So my father, it's an old story I like to tell all the time. My father always told me he went to the toilet when he was working, in a business. He was going to the toilet 25 minutes a day, just like to steal working time from his boss. Okay. Nowadays, with like all the people, like especially in the creative industries, I would call it, nobody would ever like go 25 minutes to the toilet a day, because they would think of like they would be stealing their own time. And you're somehow your own enemy. And I think there are actually a couple of really good examples in science fiction novels that address this shift going from this like strict dystopian authoritarian regime that we have to battle, going on to this like more let's say soft mechanisms of control going on there. In the 1990s, there are a couple of really good examples for that. But okay, what should we talk about?
Well, we're up to the 70s.
Okay, that's right.
The 70s are when things just went batshit. I mean, that's when you have, Ballard. Yeah. I mean, basically the shift in the 60s up through the 70s was rejecting the idea of the old science fiction rockets to space. The 60s became about, 60s and 70s became about inner space. That was one of the major changes there. The drug culture.
New wave in a certain way.
That's very much the new wave period. And Ballard's very a good example of that, both in something like Crash, which is actually a very external book.
Yeah.
But then you have a lot of his other, something like The Voices of Time, which is this very internalized book, not specifically about sexuality, but you know, part of the kind of winding down of all of human endeavor. And then you have, but then you have his other stories, like the Things Me Atrocity exhibition, which are incredibly hyper-sexualized, which you could never have done before. Actually, the Atrocity exhibition, let's plug Vail.
Yay.
Has a very good Yay. Illustrated edition of the Atrocity exhibition that you should all buy and take home and love. But then you have even fucking crazy people like Philip Jose Farmer.
Oh yes, oh my,
he's the guy
oh,
my. From that period. I mean, he's the one. I don't know where this guy came from because he started out as a fairly straight science fiction writer, and it was almost like someone said, you know, like Phil, go, and he started writing the craziest novels that were just about fucking. It was science. The Flesh is my favorite one, just in terms of the basic premise in which the astronaut goes to the other planet and has antlers surgically attached to his head and then just starts servicing an entire world of women. But then it gets even odder because he starts playing with old pulp conventions, dragging them up into this very sexualized culture, rewriting Doc Savage, a big popular pulp figure, rewriting Tarzan, in these, again, these very violent sexual ways, and then writing a book in which Tarzan and Doc Savage meet and basically rape each other. He's brilliant. If you can find any of those old books, just anything by Philip Jose Farmer from the 70s is worth reading.
So there's.
But then you have. I'm sorry. Then you also have some serious stuff too. You have Joanna Russ, you know, the first sort of serious kind of intellectual attempt to bring, this lesbian, female-oriented kind of science fiction. The Female Man is a really good example. It was basically an answer, this sort of feminist lesbian answer to Starship Troopers. Mm-hmm. And a very, very different book than anything anybody had ever seen before. And again, Tiptree is coming through that period. Does anybody remember the date of the Screwfly Solution? I can't remember when that came out. That's a really important
story. You have your iPhones. You can check it out.
Yes, if you have computers, go look up Screwfly Solution and see the actual publication date. That's really an amazing story in that it is maybe the single most despairing story about men and women.
1977.
Well, there you go. Thank you. It's maybe the single most depressing story about men and women in science fiction. I mean, it's a terrible, depressing piece of work. Brilliant.
Yeah.
It's basically a virus. There is a virus that appears in which men attempt to destroy all women. And that's...
And that's not so far off, I guess, or...
Well, again, in George Bush's America, anything's possible.
I'm from Europe, and still, I mean, there's quite some patriarchy going on still there. I don't like coming to America and pointing at Americans and saying,
"We don't care. Feel free."
The free speech thing. I don't believe it. I don't know. Free-ish speech, yes.
Yeah, free-ish. We're a, you know, constitutional-ish country, you know. You don't want to go too far with this freedom thing. So.
Okay,
yeah.
So, and we're pretty much heading up the road to the 1980s, and there's, of course, stuff going on like The Handmaid's Tale. I mean, I guess that Margaret Atwood would debate about, is it actually a science fiction novel or not?
Don't
even start the whole discussion. Yes. And I mean, that of course pops in mind because that's actually maybe a good thing because we were talking about, you know, conservative America. And I think there's this new American Republic called Gilead, I guess, something like that, where
It's a very prescient book, again, going into really what's come. I mean, for people who lived through Ronald Reagan, you didn't think things could get more fucked up.
Yeah.
You didn't think things could get worse. I mean, I remember the entire Reagan administration living in L.A. waiting for the bomb. waiting for the thought police to come and take away all your books, all your videos, all your records. And that's, you know, the kind of culture. Because the Christian thing really started bubbling up through Reagan. I mean, the religious right had been kind of plugging away before them. And Reagan was their first success on a national level. They'd been doing really well on a state and local level up to then. But Reagan was the first national figure to really carry that religious right message to the whole country. And The Handmaid's Tale is a very logical extension of what was just starting. And it just seems bizarrely prescient in which, you know, when you consider where we've gone since then.
Okay. I mean, it's soon we'll be heading up the road again, and then we'll talk about your stuff. Because, I mean, when did you start actually writing science fiction?
My first book came out in 88, and my first stories were about, like, 86 or something
so
like that.
So, I guess I think we should then round up the whole thing by talking about your stuff, because you were one of the, I guess...
It's great, because my new book has absolutely no sex in it whatsoever.
Excellent. Perfect. I mean, just staying with The Handmaid's Tale, I mean, I think even... nowadays, there's this whole like paranoia going on. We're talking about terrorism, all that stuff. There's the fear of Iraq going on. There's the fear of Iran, like trembling around. Still, again, I mean, Iran is not a free country. I mean, there's lots of bullshit going on there. I mean, homosexuals are being killed there just for being homosexual and stuff
like
that.
They're being killed here too.
Yeah. Oh, but at least not. Nobody could refer to a law saying, okay, that's...
Go to Texas.
Oh, my.
Trust me. But I live in Texas,
I find it it would be highly interesting to combine, like, the main topic of having The Handmaid's Tale and somehow, like overlapping that to the current discussions that are going on about, anti-abortion things going on, the Palin thing, and even the whole... Islam or anti-Islam moving going on. There's lots of talking about, it's about oppression. So people are oppressed there. It's a patriarchy. It's blah, 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 blah. There's lots of bullshit going on, mixing together things that are actually most of the time are like legends, I guess. And I find it highly interesting how, like in a world where we have access to lots of information, more and more paranoia is actually growing. So it's not that like the internet helped us a lot in like clarifying things.
Well, the fear now is just shifted from that 50s thing of the bomb, the Soviets, very specific things that you could point to. You know, Stalin was scary. You know, Eastern Europe was scary. What freaks people out now is it's scary, but in this very amorphous way, which is again kind of brilliant. You're not really fighting Iran. You're not really fighting Iraq. You're fighting an ideology which covers the whole globe. And I think that's where the generalized paranoia comes from. And it's the great – it's a better paranoia than the 50s because it's endless. If there's no – I mean, the Soviet Union was suddenly gone one day. 1989, boom, Soviet Union's gone. We're not as scared anymore. And ideology, just like shit you believe – someone's always going to believe that shit you believe.
Yeah.
And so it's the most brilliant kind of fear construct you could come up with.
I mean, like, it's the forever war. I mean, there's this Joe Haldeman book from the 1970s when he's pretty much, like, talking about the Vietnam War. And that's pretty, it's a pretty sexual book, actually. I think in the end, it's even like that they have this, like, completely homosexual society, whatever. Okay, so.
Getting back to sort of the sexual part of this, it's also a great time in which, because of generalized paranoia, we love to give up our rights. You know, and this illusion that we will be protected if we just do these things. And that's when, again, in this more subtle way than the Reagan administration, you do have this kind of war on thought, especially sexual thought, and that's why you're having everybody I know in the porn biz is unbelievably paranoid now, and will not, for instance, everyone has lists of places and people you cannot sell stuff. A lot of people, there's a guy I know who runs a gay porn company in the city, and it's very, he has very rigid rules about how he sells his products. You know, he will not sell to some states, he sells to jobbers with the agreement that the jobbers won't even sell in certain places because they're set up. They are literally entire states that are set up as these straw men to get you to mail something to them so that they can then prosecute you. You have prosecutions of a lot of pornography now. You have the Max Hardcore case, which is really a big one, where they finally sort of found somebody who scares enough regular people, and even enough regular porn people, that they sort of like found that guy they can go after and prosecute and seem to be winning. You know, it's a great time to just chip away at everything, especially things that scare, you know, the religious right. And there's nothing scarier than sex to that part of the world. I mean, it is, I really do believe it is the worst thing you can do. Again, growing up partly in Texas, growing up in a place where if someone talked about the devil, it was not metaphorical. It was as literal as could be. And that's the kind of world.
That's why I like Protestants. I mean, I was raised a Catholic, so we can confess, but the Protestants, they're just...
No,
they're
completely... You just put something in the plate at the end of the service. Just, you just pay money. It's basically you're buying indulgences. They just don't call it that.
Yeah.
I grew up... When we went to Texas... they actually, in the local churches, would actually publish how much money people gave. That's the kind of weird pressure these people would put on you in the South. They would literally have lists in the back of these church bulletins of, like, you know, who was stiffing us and who was a cheapskate.
My favorite Simpsons quote is, God is my... Homer Simpson says, God is my favorite science fiction character.
There you go.
That's my favorite Simpsons quote. I use it as often as I can. Good.
But that ethos we're talking about that really started coming into bloom in the 80s is when a lot of the sexual part of science fiction in the mainstream really started tapering off.
That's pretty much the nutrient fluid like your science fiction grew out of, I would say, or?
No, I came out. I was completely a new wave kid.
Okay.
I didn't read any. I hated that stuff. The stuff I was supposed to grow up with, I hated. It was boring. To me, it was just sort of this fluffy, soft return in a lot of ways to the older ideas of science fiction. Again, probably in reaction to the new wave.
Okay.
Could we like to sum up the round, because we're almost an hour now talking? How would you explain your relationship to science fiction and sex, your personal relationship? So why are you writing, at least sometimes, about sex and science fiction?
Well, I mean, they're two of
sexual. And if you don't like the question, don't answer it and just talk about something different.
Well, I'll tell you where I am right now with all this. I am not writing science fiction very much. I am writing fantasy. One specific reason... I can't make any money writing science fiction, so I'm writing other stuff. And it's interesting how the world has become divided. Science fiction has always had a troubled relationship with sex. Again, you have this sort of period of the late 60s and the 70s when it opened up, but that was kind of this almost an anomaly, and now it's gone very much down again. But in fantasy, there's this explosion of sexual stuff going on. There are entire lines now of fantasy novels that are sort of fantasy romances in which basically nice ladies and nice guys fuck vampires. It's just this, you know, it's basically the new Harlequin romance. They're just pornographic romances with werewolves, vampires, whatever. That in the genre world is where sexuality is gone. The only place you find science fiction now, which is kind of depressing, is specifically in places where they're saying, let's write about sex and science fiction. You find little, you know, little small press anthologies. You have, you know, gay anthologies, lesbian stories about sex and science fiction, gay guy stuff about sex and science fiction. You don't see it very much in the mainstream. There's a handful of writers. Samuel Delaney is probably the classic guy who, through this whole period, has just ignored basically all the rules all the way through it and wrote some amazing stuff through every generation. Dahlgren is one of those books that I read that just, it's, if you were a kid wanted to write science fiction, it just blew your mind. It's like you hadn't seen anything like this before. And it wasn't about sex. It was just simply the sexuality of these characters was just part of who they were, and it was so, you know, just thrown away that someone was gay, someone was straight, someone was bi. None of it mattered. It was just how they traveled through this world. And he's done that same thing all the way through it, exploring different roles, but not in any kind of, you know, show-offy kind of way. It's just, oh, here's how things are. I still think he's like the guy. You know, I mean, he's done it in amazing ways. Eye and Gamora is another one of those stories. It's from the 70s. Go and find that story. That's still amazing about these neutered astronauts. The people who go to space are neuters and become fetish objects. Like your alien story, they become sexual fetish objects when they come back to Earth. The story I'm going to read later on is kind of, I mean, I've remembered that story my whole life, and the story I'm reading later tonight is kind of my riff off that, because I've never been able to get that story out of my head. And so I just had to write my Eye and Gamora.
Okay, I would say maybe there are like one or two questions from the audience to wrap it up. I can't see anyone, but are there any questions?
They all look very tired.
Okay. Oh my.
Well, Angela Carter really—I mean, that great book, the Red Riding Hood anthology, The Bloody Chamber, rewriting of classic fairy tales again in almost kind of bringing a modern Brothers Grimm back to it, bringing back all the sex, sexual themes and. The violent part of the kind of sexual attitudes. Yeah, it's if you can find The Bloody Chamber, great book.
You kind of implied that you feel sexuality is more accepted in fantasy right now than in science fiction. What do you feel is different about fantasy that allows, you know, Kushiel that's not allowed in science fiction?
I don't know if it's allowed so much as it's secondary, I think, to a lot of the ways science fiction approaches sort of social constructs. Again, you have someone like Delaney who comes more from that social end of things than the kind of rocket ship part of things. A lot of science fiction remains about, you know, what if we could talk to black holes? Rather than trying to imagine what an altered social system might be like and what it's like to be a sexual person in an altered society. Whereas I think in fantasy, it's very easy to have those fetish objects. I mean, the Dracula started off as a real fetish book. I mean, that's the one that really hypersexualized the idea of the vampire, and it's never stopped. And now they just added some, they've made it to this pop product. They've added some other, you know, werewolves and ghosts and other things to it. But it's also very simple to say, vampire. You know what a vampire is. You're not explaining anything like in science fiction. You just, I want to fuck a vampire. It's there.
I was so glad you mentioned Delaney because my head was ready to explode. I was going, where's Delaney here?
No, he's one of the
and
of
the I would also say Octavia Butler. I mean, no
yeah,
one
Butler too.
Does,
yes, absolutely. She was
yes.
one I kept thinking of, but I never quite got her into
yes,
it.
Yes, yes. I mean, she does human alien sex and reproduction and miscegenation and just about better than anybody.
And again, with I think a little bit of that Tiptree thing where it's
yes.
very complicated and often it's not that kind of fun fetishism of the alien. It's very complicated, very often kind of tragic in a way.
Yes.
We kind of lost the whole chronology thing, I think. But she's an important author to mention when we're talking about this stuff, Octavia Butler, who got a MacArthur Genius Grant.
Yes. Yes. And they just announced them. And again, did we get one? I want to say something about pornography, too, if that's not out of order. The Max Hardcore prosecution, you know, is very scary. I mean, he is someone who does stuff very much on the edge, very much, you know, he's like a bad boy of porn, the way Quentin Tarantino is a bad boy of film or Jeff Koons is a bad boy of art, you know. But I find even scarier John Stagliano's prosecution. He was just indicted on 7 obscenity charges. And this is Buttman. And I teach a class on pornographic film, and I invited John Stagliano to come to my class and show the indicted videos because, of course, that would give them scientific value, you know, showing them in my classroom at the University of California, Santa Barbara. But what was really shocking about the videos is that they aren't his films. They're films made by people in his company. And they're not soft, but it's all women exchanging bodily fluids, you know, and then a little bit of light bondage and between women. So they're going after, you know, this is what the right has been wanting to do. Don't just go after the really bad stuff. You know, it's all bad. So we want you to go after the more mainstream stuff, too. And that's
precisely
what they
did. Well, but also, you have Max Hardcore, a scary guy with a scary name, and then you have Buttman. You have somebody who's, again, you know, that sounds like anal sex, which sounds like, the worst thing in the world to a certain part of the segment. I heard, what's his name, who runs the, it's not the Moral Majority, it's not the Catholic League. I'm completely blanking on his name. He gave a talk about his relationship to his daughter, and it was like 20 minutes on his daughter and anal sex. It was such an obsession about protecting his daughter from lesbians and anal sex.
Yeah, you got to watch out for that.
Okay. Yeah.
There was a lot of talk earlier about like fan fiction and
we didn't get to talk about slash fiction and stuff like that because I think that's the real modern sex area for sexuality in fiction.
Yeah, I was going to ask if you feel like there's a relationship between the growth of that movement and the sort of decline of sexuality in more traditional science fiction.
I don't think so. I think it's this whole other amazing thing. I mean, I think in a lot of ways slash fiction really is much more science fictional than most science fiction right now. It's like mashups in music. Basically, you know, you are completely appropriating media objects, remixing them in this very personal way. And I think it's incredibly radical. It's this not taken seriously by... Actually, there are a few academics now who take it very seriously. But it's a brilliant, brilliant thing to do. Completely appropriating these, it's like high art done by people who have no interest in high art, but you know, are doing it in basically taking exactly the same methodology, but and again in a more popular way, and really obsessive, amazing stuff comes out of it. I mean, look online, man. Find any kind of genre story. If you like, I mean, Star Wars came up, Star Trek came up, whatever it is, you will find slash fiction for it. A friend of mine was showing, who's obsessed with Buffy the Vampire Slayer, was showing me reams of this stuff. Of like every combination of those characters in relationships that are everything from just kind of titillating to really hardcore you know, S&M behavior. It was kind of brilliant.
And we're talking about Star Wars.
We made our way back to the dreaded Star Wars.
You actually didn't want
but
to talk about
fuck
it.
But if you Star Wars, I'm all for you.
Oh, excellent.
If you're going to deconstruct Star Wars and completely ruin it for regular Star Wars people,
I know
I'm
a guy who
side.
Did it. The guy, what's his name? George Lucas.
He managed to fuck it all up too.
He fucked it up himself.
Star Wars
I mean,
people.
What can
I was
say?
Dating a Star Wars fan when the last part of the trilogy came out, and I was literally not allowed to speak for a day because she knew what I would say. For 24 hours, I was silent.
You got Jar Jar Binks. Yes. Okay. So, any more questions or comments? Yes?
Okay. On Slash writing and the quality of Slash writing, Joanna Russ, who has done some Slash. Yeah, she's done some stories, some Slash stories. But she told Marge Piercy, who told me, forget Breadloaf, forget the Iowa Writers' Workshop. Slash Fandom is the best writing workshop around.
There you go.
And of course, any kind of fan movement is somehow like there's a certain competition in it. I think that's why it's really good to learn something there, because it's always about like I want to impress you. I want to do that. So, and there are many people out there and. On the
well, they're also going to push it further because they want to impress each other. They want to go more and more extreme and crazier, which, again, applaud them. We're going to have, I swear, I think it's out of Slash Fiction that we're going to have the next Delaney, the next Philip Jose Farmer, just this crazy, crazy writer who just has his or her own vision and just does not care about what the rest of the world and what the rest of commercial fiction is about.
Okay.
Should be a good place to end.
Yeah, maybe a last question, and then we should probably stop. Okay. Yes, of course.
Sorry. So earlier when you were talking about the them, right? That's it.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Them, yeah.
I've never seen
they
that
don't.
One, but you're kind of.
I swear to God, go rent them.
I will. It's going on Netflix. But you were kind of gesturing toward the like Lacanian dynamics, which I feel is pretty typical across like a lot of genres of fiction.
Yeah,
that's not really specific. But what I was thinking about was kind of the like maternal thing that goes on between the daughter and her doddering father, and how that plays into her role as a sex object, things like that. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how those like themes of maternity wind up playing into science fiction, and if they function in the same ways when there's a world established that doesn't even necessarily have like biological reproduction in the way that we think about it.
Well, that's the women's role in so much, really not even just science fiction, in pop fiction and genre fiction and action fiction. The woman is there to take care of the man of action, to sort of be, the person you go to for stability, but with nothing else to do in her life. Again, even if she was the lady scientist, there's nothing else there. But that goes back, that's just pulp fiction. That goes back as far as you can see any popular fiction at all. The variation on that is the kind of simple, quiet, maternalistic, or the Electra, complex character, who then becomes the kind of sexualized in that she's the object of desire by the alien. The old pulp covers, you see that. But again, that's just a pulp replacement for the woman being wanted by the foreigner. I mean, if you go back and look at the 20s, it was Chinese, it was the Fu Manchu who wants our women. Starting in about the 30s, it was little green men. And before that, if you go back, it becomes purely racial, it becomes purely foreigners. But yeah, it's all the woman is the object of desire, but not having any kind of her own sexuality in any kind of way. She's very closed, often a daughter. Often a daughter, sometimes a wife, always representing the home, always nurturing, no matter what other role she may have had. Whatever role she even may have. She may be a scientist now, but she's still the homemaker. And it's still there in a lot of ways, especially in things like, I think, like film, where everything gets simplified and codified.
Okay, I guess, last question. Thank you very much for being on the show, I guess.
My pleasure.
Richard Kadri.